In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Happy Earth Day. Earth Day, dedicated to support environmental protection, first held on this day back in 1970. The event now includes a wide range of events coordinated globally in nearly 200 countries. Today, to celebrate Earth Day on River to River, we reach back into our archives for two of our favorite conversations from 2020. Later in the hour, a conversation I had with author and biologist Neil Shubin. But first, let's start with a conversation I had in 2020 with Vietnam War veteran and author Doug Peacock. We talked about his work in the wilderness, tracking dangerous animals, his fight against climate change, and his crusade to save grizzly bears. Peacock is the author of The Essential Grizzly, The Mingled Fates of Men and Bears, Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness, and Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness. Let's go back to my conversation with Doug Peacock from 2020.
For decades, he's been a naturalist, an author, a defender of wilderness areas. That calling developed especially after his military service in Vietnam. After the war, when Doug returned to the United States, he found that solitude in the wilderness was exactly what he needed to work through his wartime experiences. In fact, he credits grizzly bears with restoring his soul. He's best known for his book, Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness. It's a memoir of his experiences in the 70s and 80s, much of which was spent alone in the wilderness of the western U.S. observing grizzly bears. His other books include Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness, that one from 2005, The Essential Grizzly, The Mingled Fates of Men and Bears from 2006. Doug will be the keynote speaker at the Nahant Marsh Education Center's second annual Oberholzer Awards. That's on February 29th. IPR is one of the sponsors of this year's event, taking place in East Moline on February 29th. The Oberholzer Awards were started to recognize local people who have dedicated their lives or will dedicate their lives to protecting our natural world. Doug Peacock joins us by phone. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Hi, Ben. It's a pleasure.
Well, I know you currently really like to talk about the threat of climate change. Before we do that, I wonder if I could ask you to take us back to your life after returning from Vietnam. Perhaps give us a snapshot of your military service, what it was like, and how your passion for the wilderness began when you returned to the U.S.
Well, I was a Green Beret medic in Vietnam in the Central Highlands, in what used to be the northern part of South Vietnam, and living with indigenous people, mountain yards mostly. But indeed, the war got there, and I stayed for two tours through the Tet Offensive. And during the Tet Offensive, as medic for 3,000 or 4,000 people, the closest thing I'd ever see to a doctor, you know, I had to handle mass casualties. And I was just too close to too much collateral damage, you know, that cowardly phrase we use when there's a bad airstrike and there's a pile of pieces of small bodies. And So once I came back to the States, I really wasn't able to be around people. And the one place I've always been comfortable is the wilderness. You know, I grew up in Michigan, and my boyhood wild places were swamps and river bottoms and woods. And so I was quite comfortable being, you know, by myself if necessary in the wildest country I could find. So when I came back in the spring of 1968, I was in the Rocky Mountains by then, and I just started camping out. And as the snows melted, I went north into the Wind River Range of Wyoming, where I had a malaria attack. And coming out of the high mountains to deal with the malaria attack, I went to Yellowstone, which is a flatter place with better weather. And I went to, and I knew the country, and I went into a hot spring area where I was planning on soaking in the hot springs, you know, the notion of hot spring spas and just healing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a whale of a paroxysm of a malaria attack there and went out of my head for about a day and a half. And after that, I was sitting in a hot creek. Now, this is, you know, in Yellowstone, a lot of thermal features. So there is a little creek that comes out of a very hot spring and ends up tepid, dumping into a major river. And so you can go up and down and kind of, you know, find little bathtubs. And I was soaking in there one cold October day with the hot water running over my neck. And by that time, it's been a summer in Alaska, but I really didn't know anything about grizzly bears. You know, I might have seen one or two at a distance, but I didn't know anything about them. And so I'm sitting there with the hot water running over my neck, and I kind of look off to my right, and there's a mother grizzly with two big yearling cubs. And she's, you know, 200 feet away across this meadow. And, you know, she's not looking at me, but I don't know anything about bears. And the only thing I know is you're not supposed to get close to mothers with cubs.
Right.
And so I decided I was going to climb a tree. You know, there's a little lodgepole forest up and down the Yellowstone country all over the place. And right in the bank of this hot spring, just 4 or 5 feet away, was a lodgepole pine. And I decided when the bears weren't looking in my direction, I was going to climb that damn tree. So they looked away. I stood up, and immediately from the whirlpool-like effects of the hot water blacked out. And it didn't matter. I was so terrified. I grabbed the tree anyway, and I hit it with my head and tore a gash in my forehead, and the blood just running down my face. But I'm so scared. I get to the top of this tree anyway. And I get to the top of this tree, and I look around, and I realize the tree that I've climbed isn't much bigger than a Christmas tree.
Oh, no.
So, yeah. And so, you know, this mother grizzly and her two yearlings, they wandered around pretending to graze, sometimes coming. They knew I was up there. They wouldn't give me the dignity to look at me, you know. And and I sat up there for 40 minutes, you know, blue from the cold, bleeding, naked as a newt, feeling like some species of silly sparrow, you know, at the top of this Christmas tree. So those bears, they got my attention, and that was the beginning.
Yes, and you've had how many encounters, even close, much closer encounters with grizzlies? Do you feel like you, in the meantime, after studying grizzlies, tracking grizzlies, being in their presence, do you understand grizzly bears, what it's like from their vantage point? Was that a goal of yours?
Well, it had to be. Otherwise, you could really get in trouble. And it's not just you that, you know, if you're involved in a bear mauling, they're going to take it out on a bear, too. So, you know, I made sure I learned quickly enough about grizzlies. And then in the beginning, I got charged by, you know, two or three dozen grizzlies, mostly mothers with cubs. Now, you know, a mother grizzly doesn't give a damn about you as long as you're no threat to her cub. Mm. And that's just universal. You know, and, you know, all that advice about if we ever get hit by a grizzly bear, play dead. It's good advice. Tough to do. But,
to play,
you know,
dead and just let them, what, they sniff you?
No, you know, if a bear is going to touch you, you should, and that's never happened to me. Two dozen bears do a partial charge and then just veer off or skid to a stop. One grizzly mother, and this was entirely my fault, charged me and skidded to a stop and ended up about really close, maybe 6 feet away. And then she leaned forward and pretended to, or appeared to sniff my pant leg. But, you know, like just last summer, so the summer before last now, I took my daughter, who saw a lot of grizzly bears in her growing up, into our last hike in Yellowstone before I walked her down the aisle. And we were sitting up on top of a windy butte in Yellowstone National Park and huddled behind a giant glacier erratic boulder. And all of a sudden, we were kind of just crouched, huddled up, and cuddled up. And I could see the expression in my daughter's face change. And I looked beyond her, and there is a mother grizzly with a single yearling cub. And the bear hasn't heard us because of the wind. She comes over a rise, and the bear's only 50, 60 feet away. That's way too close. However, you know, this grizzly, the only thing I say is, don't move. And the mother grizzly goes through all the things that a mother grizzly will when, you know, there might be a danger around. She rears, stands on her hind limbs, she looks around. That's just to see better and smell. And, you know, you can see that she's agitated by, you know, her mouth was kind of slobbers and she chomps her jaws. But after 3 or 4 minutes, the mother grizzly calms down and she and her yearling cub, it's early June, which is the mating season for grizzlies, walks right past us. I mean, like 20 feet away. Mm. And we don't move a muscle. I got my arm around my daughter. We're huddled against this rock. She walks to the edge of the cliff. And she's just barely out of view behind a little tree, a little pine tree. And all of a sudden, I can hear the sound of nursing, which is a sputtering sound. And it just doesn't happen very much. I mean, I've been hanging out with grizzlies for half a century. And, you know, you only get to hear that 3 or 4 times. She was comfortable enough to nurse her cub, you know, 30 feet away from us for 7 or 8 minutes.
She was fully aware that you and your daughter
absolutely.
Were...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she walked, you know, right. the cub would try to come a little closer than he should have because he was curious like a puppy.
Wow.
But, you know, I knew from the beginning that we were okay. The grizzly recognized that, too. And in the distance, I could hear the bellowing of a mating pair of grizzlies, you know, and they're quite vocal during the very brief mating season of early June. And that meant a male grizzly was around there. Now, for a mother grizzly, a male grizzly is the biggest threat to her cub. And you see that kind of behavior. I mean, she nursing her cub next to it. You see it often up on salmon streams. I've had... You know, Alaska, British Columbia. In British Columbia, I had a mother grizzly come and leave her 3 cubs sitting next to me on the bank. Well, I'm not moving or doing anything. She goes out and gets the salmon and comes back and collects her cubs. And, you know, the popular thinking behind that is that male big grizzlies tend to avoid humans, and so we're safer.
Wow. Doug, we've only got about 10 minutes left. I could listen to you talk about grizzlies all
day. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sort of a BSer, but yes.
I don't think it's BS, but I know what you mean. Now, these males can get to be 500-600 pounds. When they stand up, they're over 6 feet tall. So I have the feeling that with your background as a Green Beret medic, not a lot of people can be in the presence of these creatures and keep their cool, which you have many, many times. I want to devote some time, because I know another passion of yours more recently is the concern about climate change that you have. What is your message from someone who has spent so much time tracking, certainly not killing grizzly bears and other really amazing animals about climate change?
Well, climate change is the beast of our time. And, you know, there's an overlap there. The greatest threat to Yellowstone's grizzlies, that's where I live, and that's the population I'm most trying to save by connecting it with northern grizzly bears. But climate change is the biggest threat to grizzlies. It's already killed off the five-needle pine that produces the nut that Yellowstone's grizzlies, it was their most important food for millennia. But on the endangered species list now, everything has changed. It's incredibly, it's terrifying if you have children, and I have a granddaughter now. Mm. But, you know, the list of endangered animals includes everything on Earth, including the upright ape. You know, Homo sapiens are not going to be exempt for this one. Mm. And as early as this summer, I expect California-style wildfires to hit the Rocky Mountains. It's just a matter of last year we had a very snowy winter, and if it doesn't snow some more this winter, but it's really, I just wonder about modern humans. You know, the thing driving all of this seems to be just human greed. And we're like a culture with Asperger's. You know, we're brilliant. We can solve any technical or logistical problem. We know how to make money, but we lack empathy. And, you know, I think I'm going to fight to the end of my days against climate change, doing everything I can. But in fact, part of it is just looking at the unvarnished truth out there and start living your life.
Why do you think, what are your thoughts, Doug, on why you said unvarnished truth? Why do we not face it as a society, especially here in the United States? It's such a subject of controversy, despite the science that is unequivocal.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, what I said, like somebody with Asperger's disease, we don't have empathy for, you know, the Bangladeshi farmer or anybody in the third world whose effects are, you know, Australia is just the beginning. I also work in conservation in South Africa and, or, you know, like Botswana. And it's there, and it's going to sweep up. And eventually, grains will fail in Asia, and that means China. And people are not just going to stay in one place and starve. They're going to go north into Siberia, where Lord knows what's going to happen with the nuclear powers. But they'll fight it out one way or another. That endangers everybody. But meanwhile, the thing to watch are the ice sheets in Antarctica and the lack of sea ice in the northern Arctic. And I have another project to create a national park up there. It's actually already done on the Beaufort Sea in the Yukon, working with Native Inuit people. And already the permafrost is boiling methane out of it everywhere, across Siberia, across the Yukon and Alaska. Methane initially is a greenhouse gas that's up to 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide. It has a shorter half-life, but
right.
You know, that's scary.
Right. Yeah, Doug, and you give so many talks as a naturalist, an author, specializing in so many areas of wilderness, and to all age groups. I wonder, you've mentioned your granddaughter now a couple of times here. You must speak to younger groups, too. You know, you're going to fight, you say, till the end of your days, but it must be really a sensation to look at young faces and look at what's in their future.
Well, I sometimes pull my punches with high school students. It's just, they don't need to hear that. What we need to do is live fully every day and arm yourself with friendship and love the earth. And, you know, nature is such a solace. There's so much beauty in the world. And we can find that every day. And we will go on into this together. And we'll fight together. And we'll love one another. And, you know, that's not the worst thing that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Here in Iowa, talking about climate change, we're looking at more frequent severe weather due to climate change in the Midwest. What about you in Montana, where you live there near Yellowstone?
It's wildfire, simple as that. You know, the way they hit California last year, well, those conditions are increasingly possible in the northern Rockies. And I'm talking about Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. And, you know, wildfires, the huge ones, have a life of their own. There's nothing we can do to stop them. And, you know, prescribed trimming and logging and burns are a hoax. They really are not going to make any difference. And we need to prepare ourselves for that hard truth. It's coming, and maybe a lot sooner than anybody thinks. And these changes are all abrupt. You know, they don't take place. Every time somebody tells you centuries, just substitute decades. And I'm not even sure we have decades to mass on a collective scale.
We're coming to the end of this conversation. We're going way, way in a dark place. Where is the hope then, Doug?
I think that the hope is in living a really productive life and fighting for the things you know everyone's going to need, no matter what happens, no matter how dark the sky is. And that, for me, that's preserving wilderness. You know, wilderness is the original homeland of Homo sapiens. All our intelligence was evolved, you know, in the Pleistocene, and whose remnants today we'd call the wilderness. And the same thing with my grizzly bears. You know, what habitat do they need most? Well, the stuff that most closely resembles wilderness. And so that's my small effort to preserve a place where, you know, hopefully things can survive. I don't know about evolve. The rate of change that's going on now is perhaps as much as 10,000 times the rate of organic evolution. You know, we can't adapt to this kind of change in temperatures.
Doug, we've got a couple minutes left, and I wanted to pose this to you in the final minute or two we have of our conversation. It's been such a delight, and your life has been so magnificent from growing up in Michigan, being a Green Beret medic, two tours of duty in Vietnam, and then your whole career dedicated to preserving wilderness and with grizzlies. Can you, in closing, Doug B. Peacock, describe for me in a bit of detail a perfect day for you? What would you wish if you could wake up tomorrow? Maybe each of your days are nearly perfect. What is Doug Peacock's perfect day?
Well, I've had a bunch of them. I'm just a lucky sucker. Now I'm down in the Sonoran Desert. And being out, I buried Ed Abbey, my old friend, about 100 miles to the west of me, and journeying out to his grave in this beautiful low desert is an incredible day. And when I get back home, the grizzlies will emerge from their dens, and I've got a favorite hill in a thermal area. It's wild, but there's steam vents and hot springs all over, and the buffalo die there in the wintertime, and the grizzlies come in the spring and feed on them. And I just sit up there, looking out at this huge expanse of meadow, waiting for the grizzly to come in and take his turn with the wolves at the buffalo carcass. And I don't have to do much. I don't have to be very active to have a perfect day. That, you know, the beauty of nature is always there. In Yellowstone, you're gifted with the presence of bison. You know, the buffalo that almost went extinct, when in 1902 they could only count 23 wild animals left in Yellowstone Park. And their great-grandchildren are there every day, and I love their company. Their kinship gives me great pleasure.
We have received so much pleasure from your conversation to Iowa Public Radio listeners. Doug Peacock, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Bannon, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Doug Peacock, naturalist, author, Vietnam veteran.
That conversation with Doug Peacock, recorded in 2020. Coming up after a short break, another conversation from last year to mark today, Earth Day. We'll hear from author and biologist Neil Shubin. His latest book is titled Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. That's after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. Iowa Public Radio News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Hear First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters, learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Hear First today wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and today you're listening to an archive edition of River to River.
Well, we've all heard the basics of how life evolved over billions of years on Earth, how ancient fish evolved from the waters of our planet to walk on land, how reptiles transformed into birds that fly, how our primate ancestors, our ancestors, evolved into Homo sapien, humans that walk on two legs, talk, and write, and listen to Iowa Public Radio. My guest is best-selling author and biologist Neil Shubin. His latest book is titled Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. In it, Shubin offers a new view of evolution that explains how the incredible diversity of life on our planet came to be. He is the Robert R. Bensley Professor of Organismal Biology and Anatomy at the University of Chicago. His previous books include The Universe Within and Your Inner Fish. That one was chosen by the National Academy of Sciences as the best book of the year in 2009. What a great honor and pleasure to have you on our program, Neil Shubin.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start off. I want to quote a little bit from the prologue of your book. You write, "If you think feathers arose to help animals fly, or lungs and legs to help animals walk on land, you'd be in good company. You'd also be entirely wrong." Explain why we would be wrong.
Yeah, you know, so we have this view in evolution, we've had this view in evolution that, you know, somehow you have to, when these great revolutions in the history of life happen, like when fish evolved to take the first steps on land, let's just look at that for example. We know at about 375, 380 million years ago, you know, life made the shift from water to land. Before that point, you know, there were fish living in water, but really kind of nothing but plants and invertebrate animals on land. Then at some point, our distant ancestors started to take those first steps. Well, you know, you'd naively think that, you know, legs and lungs and fingers and toes and all these things that critters use to walk on land, that they were necessary inventions that arose at that point. Well, the more we look, the more we find that that's just simply not true. That is, lungs arose well before, eons before, fish ever took their first steps on land. Limbs with, you know, arm bones, elbows, wrists, and stubby fingers arose well before fish ever walked on land. The descendants of fish. And we see that in the fossil record. We see that in the genome. And, you know, it's remarkable. You go and look at diverse fish, and pretty much all fish have some sort of air sac that lies adjacent to the gut tube. In a lot of fish, it's a lung. There are lung fish. There are other fish that have lungs. They have both lungs and gills. They use both of them to breathe. They'll use the gills to breathe in water when there's lots of oxygen content is high in the water. They'll use the lungs when the oxygen content decreases, and they'll just go to the surface and breathe air. That strategy was around for eons before fish took their first steps on land. So the key take-home message is that you don't as much need new inventions to do new things in evolution. It's using old inventions in new ways, using the old to make the new. It's repurposing. It's tinkering. And that kind of tinkering has led to some great revolutionary changes in the history of life on our planet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so walk us through then step by step, because I'm not sure you've completely exploded my myth and the myth of many others about how sea creatures came to the land. What would be the steps then if they didn't sort of develop legs out of flippers to walk on land?
Well, they did. So let me just give you, so basically my team and I, working in the Canadian Arctic, we're working on rocks about 375, 380 million years old, and we discovered, and we were looking for it, we discovered a fish with fins, with scales, with fish-like bones, but it also had limb bones inside the fin. It had a humerus, that is, upper arm, a radius. I mean, it had an upper arm, forearm, even parts of a wrist. It had lungs and gills. And so when you look at this, what you have are a bunch of fish, oh, say 390, 375 million years ago, who were living in shallow streams, walking on water bottoms, living in the shallows, were able to use lungs and gills, were supporting themselves with their arm bones, doing a form of push-up, which is what these ancient fossils can do. And it turns out that when you have that sort of system, you already have a creature that's able to live on land when it needs to. And the question is, you know, it's not necessarily evolving new structures, but it's basically using those new old structures in new ways when they need to. Mm. And so if you were to look at those streams 375 million years ago, it was a pretty harsh environment. There are, you know, all kinds of carnivorous fish, and land was loaded with food, invertebrates and plants and so forth, but no competitors. So there came a moment when all those inventions that were really great for living in certain kinds of water environments became useful for life on land. So the shift is really kind of not the origin of new stuff. It's using old stuff in new ways when the opportunity arises.
Okay. Neil, let's address the other sort of complex and evolutionary question that you tackle in this book. How organisms bearing no immediately perceptible resemblance to each other, dinosaurs and birds can be closely related. So there we have the other real puzzling thing. How did birds evolve from reptiles? They couldn't be more different when we look at them today, could they?
No, when you look at them today, you know, you look at a crocodile and you look at a bird, they look extremely different. But when you go to the fossil record, all of a sudden you start to bridge those gaps. See, that's why I love being a paleontologist, honestly. You know, I mean, it's like you see the world today. Then when you crack rocks, you start to see what the world looked like hundreds of millions of years ago. And, you know, you look at that and you say birds have feathers. And nothing else has feathers. Birds use those feathers to fly. So obviously feathers arose to help birds fly. Well, the story's a lot like lungs. No, sorry, the feathers arose well before. That is, if we look at theropod dinosaurs, carnivorous dinosaurs, what you find is they get very, 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 underline very, bird-like. They have a bird-like wrist. They have bird-like arms. They have bird-like hollow bones. They have air sacs that look something like they or like a bird-like lung. And importantly, the fossils are revealing that many of these dinosaurs, in fact, most of them, had feathers. So feathers we first see in the fossil record, not in birds, but we see them in dinosaurs. And we see them in the most bird-like of all dinosaurs, the theropod dinosaurs. And these are dinosaurs that had extremely high metabolisms. We know that when we look at the cellular structure of their fossils, their bones. We know they had feathers. We know they had that they were able to run very fast, high-activity lifestyles, much like birds today. So these dinosaurs were approaching a bird-like form. And yet they weren't capable of flight. Flight, we believe, arose as there are a couple different scenarios. There are a couple different ideas that are out there. One is that as animals became faster and faster, taking ever greater leaps, that they would be able to take off from the ground. A proto-feather would enable them to take ever-increasing leaps off the ground. Mm. Others view it as their relationship with that maybe that these dinosaurs were running up and down trees, and that they were able to, you know, go from heights when they were in the trees and things like that. But either with either scenario, the one fact that we have is that the fossil record shows that a bird-like anatomy first appears in dinosaurs, and that includes feathers. And so the history of feathers is shifting their function from the function they had in dinosaurs, which may be, you know, sexual displays, thermoregulation, insulation, that kind of thing, to flight. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not like feathers had to be an invention to help animals fly. Feathers, like lungs, well before in the history of life, were already around and repurposed.
So in this repurposing, to go along with sort of, I guess, Darwin's theories and evolution, so this increased ability to hop because they could gain advantage through these early feathers or perhaps come from a tree, mm-hmm. fall down from a tree, that gave them an advantage, and that's how sort of birds exploded, the species of birds exploded?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. So either one of those scenarios would bring about the same result, which is a lineage that can fly. And there's a whole, when you can fly, there's a whole new world that's open for you. It's just like when creatures took those first steps on land. Same thing. A whole new world opens up and, you know, their descendants just take over.
My guest, if you just joined us, is author and biologist Neil Shubin. Some Assembly Required, his book, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossil to DNA. A central question you address in your book, Neil, is how do these large changes in history of life come about? So when we throw in DNA, what is new? How have we coupled our technology to explore DNA with these prehistoric fossils?
You know, oh my gosh, our world has changed so much in the last few decades because of the revolution in genomic technology. It's really remarkable. You know, we've had, you know, the Human Genome Project. We all remember when that was published. But since that time, we've had thousands upon thousands of genome projects where we now have the genomes of microbes, viruses, bacteria, flies, fish, worms, people of different kinds. I mean, we just have just so many different kinds of genomes. We are now able to ask the question and compare the genomes of two kinds of animals and say, what at the genetic level makes them different? Mm-hmm. You know, we can begin to probe that. That's just amazing. What are the list of genes that make a chimpanzee different from a person or a person different from a fish? We can now access that at the level of DNA. And that is really has been full of surprises. You know, for a long period of time, our window into the history of life were, you know, anatomy and fossils, things like that. Now we have this whole new record that is just not only revealing us what the similarities and differences at the genetic level among species, but also, you know, what drives those differences? What makes them different? You know, and so we can get to so many questions that were not accessible to us before. And that's why in the book I try to weave together our approaches from fossils with those from genomes, because together they tell us some important facts.
Mm-hmm. Does DNA survive in any of these really old fossils?
Not the really old ones, no. And we have DNA of some old fossils, but it's not like the level of, say, dinosaur DNA or some of the fish that walked on land DNA. What we can do, though, is we can do this. Let me give you one experiment, mm-hmm. set of experiments that my lab did. We can look at the DNA that builds, say, an organ in people and mice, something like that. And so we can ask the question, what DNA is active when our limbs are forming, when our fingers and toes form, and you know, from egg to adult? You know, we start as a single cell, a fertilized egg. You and I and your listeners are 4 trillion cells sitting here. So somehow we go from a single cell to 4 trillion cells, and in the process, our organs are built, our bodies are built, our tissues are built, and that comes about by DNA being turned on and off to make these different organs. Well, we can ask the question then is, okay, well, the genetic recipe that builds a hand and an arm of people, is that present in other creatures living today? And what are the similarities and differences? Well, it turns out that the genetic recipe that builds our arms and legs is very similar to that builds the arms and legs of mice. No surprise there, probably. There are subtle differences, but they are subtle. And we can trace that deeper and deeper and deeper still. It turns out that fish have those genes too, and those genes are active as fish make their fins. And it turns out the genes that sculpt our wrists and digits, okay, are present in fish. And what are they doing? They're making the terminal end of fish fins. You know, so we can modify. I could take the genes from a fish that makes the terminal end of their fish fin, right? And I can put it in a mice. This is the technologies we have now. We could pop it in a mouse and ask what it does. And guess what it does? It's making the terminal end of a mouse limb. You know, so we can swap the genes between species.
Wow.
Take a mouse gene and put it in a fish, put a fish gene inside a mouse. This is the technology we have. And we can begin to ask the question, what's the fish gene doing in the mouse context, and vice versa? Well, guess what? In a lot of these things, it turns out the fish kind of knows its way around the mouse genome, the fish genome. And the only reason for that is we have this deep similarity of the of many of the important toolkit pieces, genes, that build bodies. It's already there. And so a lot of evolution, again, is repurposing. Like we talked about repurposing with, you know, feathers and lungs, but we see it at the genetic level too. A lot of, you know, evolution is not necessarily, there's some of this in, you know, the origin of new genes, but also it's repurposing, using old genes in new ways. So the fish fin genes were repurposed to make hands and feet. Let's put it that way.
Neil Shubin is my guest. Some Assembly Required, his latest book. Here's a part of your book that I have to bring up, especially in the current context of the corona outbreak. You point out that our genome is full of ancient viruses that invaded our DNA. That doesn't sound like a good thing at all, Neil, but explain the part they play in making us who we are. I think your example in the book is memory, right?
Yeah, now this is truly, I mean, I use the term mind-blowing, but yeah, for a memory gene, I'm sorry about that. But it really is, because if you look at our genome, only 2% of our entire genome contains our genes, the sections that, you know, encode for proteins. The rest of that 98% is just a lot of other stuff that is important, but has other more complex activities. Turns out when we mine our genome, when we look at the sequence, it turns out that 8% of our genome consists of ancient viruses that invaded the genomes of our distant ancestors only to be knocked out, only to be rendered, you know, neutered, useless. So we have 4 times more viral genetic material inside our own DNA than our own genes. And when scientists from the University of Utah started to look at, they weren't virologists, they were just like studying memory, they found a memory gene called ARC, A-R-C. They were looking at ARC and how it plays a role in memory. It's a very important gene in humans. And in fact, some neurodegenerative diseases are related to, you know, changes in the activity of ARC, this gene. So they, you know, like any good scientist, they wanted to look at the genetic structure of this gene and the proteins it makes. They were like taking it apart at the molecular level. And they were in for a huge, huge surprise. And the surprise was the more they looked at the protein structure and the way that ARC works to in memory, it's functioning as a virus. That is, it is a modified virus that this this gene, so important for memory, is actually a modified virus that invaded the genome of our distant ancestors eons ago, and then itself was put to use. It was repurposed by those ancient genomes to play a role in memory.
That's amazing. How long have we known that?
Two, 3 years, something like that. It's pretty new. Wow. 2 years was when the paper was published. Yes, it's all pretty new. And there are other genes like in the placenta, you know, obviously very so important in reproduction. Those also have a viral origin as well. So, you know, if you look at the history of life, it's really been this, you know, balance, this interaction between, you know, bodies and genomes and viruses. And viruses are continually invading. In most cases, they're kind of neutral in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
They invade the genome only to get knocked out. In other cases, they can be quite devastating. You know, they can wreak havoc on the world, as we're witnessing now. But still other times they invade and then they become fuel for evolution, you know, which is, that's a whole new story.
Right.
This is just all new stuff. And that's kind of, when I was reading the scientific literature, about this stuff, I was thinking, gosh, you know, this is just amazing science. We're living in a great age of science. And I wanted to tell those stories.
Mm-hmm. In this book, Neil Shubin, you write about many different scientists. You trace over centuries the understanding of our evolution here, taking on such topics as genetic alterations, mutations. But these are very interesting scientists, natural philosophers, researchers. Tell us about one that perhaps is a favorite of yours, a person perhaps had some personal habits, or you are a scientist, so you must feel really attached to a lot of these people.
One of the joys of writing a book like this is I do sort of a deep dive into these people, some of whom have been unheralded, but who lived these incredible lives of discovery, just trying to learn about our world. And one of them, one of my favorites, there's so many, but the one I tell in the book, who I just actually, you know, just warmed my heart, was this woman by the name of Julia Platt. Julia Platt went to the University of Vermont, and she wanted to become a biologist. So she started to study, after graduating from Vermont, she wanted to study development, you know, the process by which, you know, you go from an egg to an adult to understand how bodies are built. And, you know, this is the mid-1800s, and there was no room for women in science. So she went to Germany and got a PhD in Germany, where the environment was a little more fruitful, and then came back to the United States and started to do work in Massachusetts at the Marine Station, studying salamanders and sharks and so forth. And she did her thing, and she discovered something that really didn't make sense to a lot of people. She discovered that the development of our head, really big parts of our head, relied on a whole different kind of cell that people did not expect before. It was sort of an esoteric discovery. She made this esoteric discovery about the cell type that gave rise to heads. But people didn't disagree. People disagree with her so strongly that she had to leave the field. So she made this big discovery. No one believed her. Very few, actually, one person did, but that wasn't enough. She ended up writing then the president of Stanford University in the late 1800s, saying, "Look, I did this work, and I can't get a job. I'm gonna have to leave science if I can't get a job anywhere." And she ended up leaving science and moving to Pacific Grove, California, never to do scientific research again. But she was just an amazing human being. She ended up getting elected mayor of Pacific Grove and then ended up leading an effort to save Monterey Bay. All right. So there's an amazing person who would not be stopped. And it turned out that after she died, saving Monterey Bay, mayor of Pacific Grove, that discovery she made, that seemingly esoteric discovery, it turned out to be fundamental, because other people then confirmed it and extended it to show that many of the organs in our body, as we compare ourselves to other creatures, came about as the result of a new kind of cell, that you can trace all these complex evolutionary changes to our bodies to one cell type that arose in the distant past. So it's not like there were hundreds of different changes that happened that had to happen independently of our body. It meant really just kind of one thing, a new kind of cell. And so she showed an important pathway which evolution and development and embryology likely happened, and in a remarkable life story. You know, so I was I did a deep dive into her life, and there are others like it. And I just, you know, just being able to write about that is such a privilege to me.
Wow. Author and biologist Neil Shubin has been with us for this portion of the program. Neil, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Some Assembly Required is Neil's book, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA.
My conversation with Neil Shubin was recorded in 2020. Thanks for tuning in this hour to a couple of conversations from our archive that we thought well-suited for today, Earth Day, a day dedicated to support for environmental protection. First held back in 1970, though now it's a global celebration of this planet we call home in nearly 200 countries. Tomorrow on the program, we wrap up our week on River to River, as we like to on Fridays, with a News Buzz edition. Half a dozen quick conversations to end this news week, including IPR's Natalie Krebs with a COVID update on our vaccination campaign, Aaron Murphy on what lawmakers have been up to this week at the Iowa State House, and I'll talk with one of the attorneys involved in the case of a white Cedar Rapids police officer who shot and paralyzed a black motorist in 2016. An $8 million settlement was reached this week, one day before the lawsuit was to go to trial. We'll hear more about that tomorrow here on River to River. This archive edition of River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.